Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, you can hear the Mozart anniversary feature. I loaded onto Pope Benedict's white Nano iPod when he visited our radio station, as well as an exclusive interview with the late Charlton Heston. But first of all, I'd like to begin by joining Emma McCarthy as she brings us a report on Pope Benedict XVI's weekly general audience in St. Peter's Square.
After the Easter break, Pope Benedict XVI returned to his teachings on the lives of the early fathers of the Church this Wednesday, as he greeted thousands of visitors and pilgrims in an overcast St. Peter's Square for the general audience. This week, the Pope began a catechesis on the father of Western monasticism, St. Benedict.
The most important source of information on his life is the second book of the Dialogues of Pope St. Gregory the Great. Writing in a time of turmoil and moral decadence following the fall of the Roman Empire, Pope Gregory believed that the life and rule of Benedict could be a light, leading the people of Europe out of darkness.
Saint Benedict was born in 480 in the region of Nursia. He came to Rome to study, but soon left the city so as to live in silence and to please God alone. He spent some time in a religious community before becoming a hermit in a cave.
After struggling victoriously against the fundamental human temptations of pride, sensuality, and anger, he decided to found a monastery at Subiaco. Years later, he established a new community in a mountain, Monte Cassino, to symbolize the public role of a monastery, called to be a light shining for the good of the church and society. Indeed, when he died in 547, St. Benedict left behind a thriving spiritual family and a rule which invites us to search for God in prayer, obedience, and humility while attending faithfully to daily duties and to souls in need.
In 1964, Pope Paul VI proclaimed St. Benedict patron of Europe, recognizing the role that his teaching and his disciples had played in shaping Europe's spiritual life and culture. Pope Benedict concluded Wednesday with a fervent wish that Europe's new unity may be enlightened and nourished by a religious and moral renewal drawn from its Christian roots.
May our lives, after the example of St. Benedict, be lived in humility, prayer, obedience to God, and faithful service to your neighbor. May the Lord bless you and your families.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
Geheiligt werde dein Name.
And many thanks there to Emma McCarthy for bringing us Pope Benedict's words there this Wednesday. Pope Benedict, who at this same time next week will be on a pastoral journey to the United States. Something he mentioned himself on Tuesday at a press conference in the Vatican in a recorded message addressed to American Catholics, where he said, among other things, well, let's listen.
Together with your bishops, I have chosen as the theme of my journey three simple but essential words: Christ, our hope. Following in the footsteps of my venerable predecessors, Paul VI and John Paul II, I shall come to the United States of America as Pope for the first time to proclaim this great truth: Jesus Christ is hope for men and women of every language, race, culture, and social condition.
And now, after hearing this message, let's move on in the broadcast. As promised, to speak of the contents of Pope Benedict's iPod, something all kinds of people in the United States have been quizzing me about. Well, here goes the story. When Pope Benedict XVI came to visit us here at Vatican Radio in March of 2006, we presented him with a white iPod Nano, loaded, among other things, with one of the music programs I personally produced on the occasion of the 250th anniversary of the birth of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart in January of that same year. It's a program presented by a music historian who currently works as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. His name, Monsignor Philip Whittemore. Well, stay tuned then.
Music, maths, and chess. Those are said to be the three areas where you find child prodigies, able even at a tender age to perform as well as the great masters. This year, we're celebrating the 250th anniversary of the birth of one of the greatest child prodigies of all time, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, born in Salzburg in January 1756. I don't know what he was like at maths, and I don't know whether he played chess, but his musical accomplishments from early childhood on are legendary. By age 14, he'd already composed about 100 works, and he continued producing about 25 each year until his death just over 20 years later. The piece we've been listening to was written on a visit to London when the composer was 9 years old. The autograph manuscript is kept in the British Library. The Mozart family spent 15 months in London. This was just one of the many tours arranged by Wolfgang's father Leopold to show off the amazing talent of his young son and his daughter Nannerl. The children were taken to the leading cities of Europe and to the courts of kings and princes. They took Europe by storm. There's a well-known story about Mozart's visit to Rome as a young lad of 14. He heard the Sistine Choir singing Allegri's Miserere. In those days, so the story goes, it wasn't possible to get hold of the music. Only the Sistine Choir had copies of it. But the 14-year-old Mozart heard it performed once and then wrote the whole piece down from memory. The secret was out. That story isn't as far-fetched as it might seem. Allegri's Miserere is quite repetitive, and for a receptive young musical mind, it's not impossible to imagine being able to commit the whole piece to memory. Though, I must admit, I wouldn't have wanted to be set an exercise like that when I was taking my final exams in music. That sort of childhood is bound to leave its mark. From a musical point of view, it meant that Mozart was exposed to the stimulus of a wide range of different styles, all of which he was able to assimilate into his own mature style. J.S. Bach picked up the style of French and Italian music by painstakingly copying manuscripts. Mozart picked it up by travelling all over the continent and hearing the music at first hand. Thank you. Nowadays, I think most people would question whether a childhood like that was really a good way to prepare for adult life. Things began to go wrong for young Wolfgang quite early. It was hard for him to settle in Salzburg, where he and his father were court musicians of the Prince Archbishop. The Archbishop didn't really appreciate the immense talent of his young servant. At the age of 21, Mozart set off on his travels again, accompanied by his mother. First to Mannheim, where Mozart fell in love with a young singer, Aloysia Weber, but his hopes of marriage were disappointed. So too were numerous attempts to find more suitable employment at various princely courts. On they went to Paris, where Mozart's mother took ill and died. The break from an increasingly difficult situation in Salzburg came in 1781, by which time Mozart was 25 years old. He was able to establish himself in Vienna, where the opportunities for a freelance musician were much greater. He married Constanze Weber, younger sister of his first love, Aloysia. And he made himself popular in Vienna by composing an opera in the German language, the kind of thing the Emperor Joseph II liked to encourage. As a pianist, Mozart quickly became the darling of the Viennese public. His piano concertos were written mostly for himself to play, and he captured the hearts of the audiences with his virtuoso playing and his astonishingly rich invention. Vienna too, Mozart became a friend of the great Joseph Haydn, 24 years his senior. He paid Haydn the great compliment of dedicating to him a set of 6 fine string quartets. And on hearing them, Haydn said to Leopold Mozart, "Before God and as an honest man, I tell you that your son is the greatest composer known to me, either in person or by name. He has taste, and what is more, the most profound knowledge of composition." It's often illuminating to know something of the circumstances behind Mozart's compositions, and especially to know the performers he had in mind. Most of his piano concertos, as I mentioned just now, were written for himself to play. Sometimes he wrote for pupils or amateurs, and then he tended to write rather more simply. When he was writing for professional soloists, if they had any particular specialities, he'd give them plenty of opportunity to shine. The bass aria we heard earlier from Mozart's German opera Die Entführung was written for Ludwig Fischer, who could produce some amazingly low notes. And Mozart's friendship with the clarinetist Anton Stadler has given us the wonderful Clarinet Concerto. There were probably two things Mozart wanted above all as a professional composer. One was the opportunity to write opera. In this he was reasonably successful. In May 1786 his opera Buffa, The Marriage of Figaro, was a tremendous success, and when it travelled to Prague the audiences there clamoured for more. Mozart gave them more the following year. In October 1787, Prague was treated to the first performance of the opera Don Giovanni. The other thing Mozart wanted was a job. It was all very well to be a freelance musician, but it was insecure. To tell the truth, it had only recently become possible because public concerts were quite unknown until the 18th century. Before that, a composer could only make a living by writing for the church, the court, or the opera theatre. A job at the court would have suited Mozart right down to the ground. In 1787 he obtained one as chamber composer to the imperial court, but it was hardly worthy of his genius. All that was required of him was to write dance music for annual balls. He got the job largely because the emperor wanted to keep him in Vienna and didn't want him seeking his fortune elsewhere. If any of you have seen the film Amadeus, you'll probably be familiar with the legend that Mozart was poisoned by an envious rival, Antonio Salieri. It's true that Mozart's genius far surpassed that of Salieri, but if anything, Mozart had more reason to envy Salieri than the other way round. Salieri had exactly the job Mozart longed for, court Kapellmeister to the emperor. But Mozart would never acquire such a distinguished position, and towards the end of the 1780s, he began getting into financial difficulties. He'd been fated when he first arrived in Vienna, but the public is notoriously fickle. His personal life was not without its troubles either. Four of his six children died in infancy. Some of the sadness of this dark period in his life comes through in music of deep tragedy. By 1791, Mozart was writing begging letters to many of his friends and influential supporters. He struggled hard to gather enough commissions to pay his bills. An opportunity came through a friend and colleague to write a popular pantomime-type opera for a suburban theatre. It might sound unpromising, but in The Magic Flute, Mozart managed to produce music of extraordinary genius, despite the less than ideal circumstances. It's well known that the commission for a Requiem Mass came from a stranger who refused to give his name or the reason for the commission, but he was offering payment, and Mozart accepted the work. Deeply superstitious, he became convinced that he was writing the Requiem for himself. Alas, this turned out to be the case. At the time of his death in December 1791, aged only 36, he left an unfinished score. Thanks to the notes he left behind, though, his pupil Süssmayr was able to complete the work, Mozart's final masterpiece. Can only begin to wonder what Mozart might yet have produced had he lived as long as his friend Joseph Haydn, who reached the grand old age of 77. But in his 36 years, he left us with a marvellous collection of works of genius. 41 symphonies, 30 piano concertos, 27 string quartets, and over a dozen operas, including the ones he wrote in his childhood. What he gave us is an incomparable treasure. In thanks for all that we received from him, let's remember to say a prayer for the repose of his soul.
My thanks there go to music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore, who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Finally, to end the broadcast, a special tribute to Charlton Heston, who died Sunday, April the 5th, at the age of 84. Widely known for his role as Moses in the 1956 Hollywood classic, The Ten Commandments, but also for playing Ben-Hur and indeed Michelangelo in The Agony and the Ecstasy, when he came to Rome in 1989, my colleague Lana Hale caught up with him. Let's listen.
There's been a common thread that has run through your choices of projects to do, most recently A Man for All Seasons on stage, and other films of a religious nature. What attracted you to these films? Were they things that just came to you, or did you seek them out?
In the case of Man for All Seasons, I sought it out. I think it's the best play written in the last generation. I began doing it on the stage, in the mid-60s, not long after it was first done, which was 1960. I've done 5 productions on the stage, most recently in London and some other English cities for a 5-month run last year and the year before. And then after I closed that run, we made a film of the play. I don't mean of the production, we made a movie. And included in our cast for the film, John Gielgud, Vanessa Redgrave, and Richard Johnson, which are pretty good inclusions. And I, as I said, that one I wanted as much to do as I wanted to do the Shakespearean projects I've done and so forth. In the case of the only 2 other films I've done that I would describe as religious films, 10 Commandments and Greatest Story Ever Told, though I was delighted to play on the one hand Moses and the other John the Baptist, they came to me. I didn't make them happen. Ben-Hur is widely regarded as a religious film, but I don't. I think that's a pretty loose. It's really a melodrama whose high point is a chariot race. And though Christ is a significant figure, he's never seen on the screen. It's true that the protagonist, a passionately revolutionary Jew, is converted to Christianity at the end. But to the extent that qualifies it as I'd call it a melodrama with religious overtones.
Another one of your very popular roles was that of Michelangelo, the painter of the Sistine Chapel. Are you going to be visiting the chapel itself on this trip?
I hope very much to. I'm trying to arrange through the Vatican to get a private look at my handiwork.
Jumping from Rome to Los Angeles, you greeted the Pope when he arrived there. How did that come about, your being the official greeter for the Screen Actors Guild itself?
No, I was, that's an exaggeration. I was proud to be one of, maybe some 25 or 30 people from the film community to whom the Pope spoke for 15 minutes. And then he did greet me and some others. But I suspect, unless he'd been told about how I'd painted his ceiling, that was a random choice, or perhaps because I'm taller than most of them. But it was a very moving experience. The film community is not noted for its religious orientation, let alone for its Catholic orientation. And everyone there was visibly struck by the chemistry of His Holiness.
You've been listening to our special tribute to Charlton Heston, who died Sunday, April the 5th, at the age of 84. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening, and should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.